The Lord is my rock and my fortress. Oh, I'm sorry. I will love you, O Lord, my strength. The Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer, my God and my strength, in whom I will trust, the buckler and the horn of my salvation and my high tower. I will call upon the Lord who is worthy to be praised. So shall I be saved from my enemies. I have to admit that since I've memorized this little snippet of Psalm 18, I've kind of used it a lot like in Dune, where the people go, I will not fear, fear is the mind killer, right? I mean, when bad things are happening, I hold my ground by repeating the opening phrases of Psalm 18, which I don't know is strictly how you're supposed to use it, but that's what I've done with it. So it's always kind of had a special place in my heart as far as that goes. Okay, so let me just start off by reading the superscript up on top. It says, and David spoke to Yahweh the words of this song in the day that Yahweh delivered him from the hand of all of his enemies and from the hand of Saul. Oh, whoops. I was in the wrong place. That's 2 Samuel chapter 22. What do you know? So 2 Samuel 22, there are subtle differences between 2 Samuel 22 and Psalm 18, but they're subtle. And they're not huge differences at all. For example, the he said appears in verse 1 instead of in the superscription, which is where it appears in 2 Samuel. And fortunately for us, this gives us a lot of context, because it says here that when David is saved from his enemies on every side and from Saul, and it appears after David gets done fighting a whole bunch of wars, way after he has to deal with Saul. So it's clearly not just talking about his enemies, you know, that were hanging out with Saul, but with all of his enemies. And so just to remind you the context here, what the occasion of this psalm that David is writing about, David is talking about how throughout his life, he's been delivered by God. Now, and it's also profitable to remember that David gets by on his relationship with God. When, you know, we were in grade school, he was not studying the sword. He's not a samurai. He's not John Wick. He's not a lifelong warrior. He's a shepherd. He makes it through God delivering him. And that's important when you read Psalm 18, because we're going to get into the weeds on how David makes it as someone whose job it is to lead Israel and defeat their enemies, despite the fact that he's a shepherd, which it's, you know, I think you can have pretty good sling skills as a shepherd. He showed those off with Goliath, but, you know, there's a lot of stuff that he's getting through just strictly on the fact that God is his deliverer. So after dealing with this problem with Saul, he's going to have a civil war with Ish-bosheth. It's not going to be a super long one, and he's going to have the upper hand in that. And then he's going to have to get into some fights with the Jebusites in order to take Jerusalem. They have some interesting battles there. Then he has to fight the Philistines and kick them out of the hill country, which disappoints them because they thought he was going to be on their side, because he had been up until that point, if you follow that. And then he has to fight them again because, you know, they had been in charge. And so you can't just do it once. He has to kick them out of the hill country once again. And then there's a brief interlude where he gets promised an eternal kingdom and everything. And then he has to fight the Philistines again. He fights against Moab. He crushes their army. He kills 2/3 of their military-aged men. And then he reduces them to tributaries. He fights with the Arameans. He stations troops in Damascus. He places garrisons in the Edomite cities. Then he has to deal with the rebellion of his son Absalom. And other Israelites go to war with him. And then he gets this guy Sheba of Benjamin who goes to war with him. And then he has to go to war with the Philistines again and again, because they're just not getting the message. And in all of this, Goliath's siblings are going to fall in battle. And again, the image that continues to run through here, as I've mentioned in earlier Psalms, is this idea of the Davidic king ruling on this earth because he is the chosen instrument of Yahweh who rules over the entire universe. And this Davidic king points forward to the perfect Davidic king who is Christ, right? And so there's always that flavor coming through and that context that the passage is going to be in. Right, so now we can get into the actual meat of the passage as we move through, as we've gotten through the context. He says, "I love you, O Yahweh, my strength. Yahweh is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer, my God, my rock in whom I take refuge, my shield and the horn of my salvation, my stronghold. I call upon Yahweh who is worthy to be praised, and I am saved from my enemies." Moving up to verse 3, and I think it's really important here to take a step back and understand the imagery that David is using. Because otherwise, the full import of what he's talking about is not going to be known to us, and the rest of our understanding of this passage is going to suffer, right? I apologize about the First John thing. I forgot to change that. I was saving as over an old PowerPoint presentation. It's easier than having to start a new one, and I forgot. So here we have, the Lord is my rock. And so it's not talking about either of those kinds of rocks, because that one wasn't born yet, and they hadn't gotten googly eyes on that one. No. What it's talking about when it talks about a rock is it is talking about... Okay, so these are buildings, right? These are buildings. Imagine if you had decided that you did not want somebody with a sword to poke a hole in you, right? Or with a spear, or even with a bow. You don't want them to poke a hole in you. Can you think of a better place to be? Just try to poke a hole in somebody from down here when they're up here. Now imagine, these are ruins right now, so these walls are actually all fully functional, right? Even Rome took years to take this thing from a handful of men. This is a rock. This is a fortress up on top of the rock, right? Now this is a particularly good rock and fortress. David didn't have access to this particular rock and fortress, but this is what he's talking about. Right, this is the Masada. This is the sort of thing he's talking about. This is a place of safety. This is the sort of place of safety that you want to be in when the danger's threatened. Because danger's not getting in there. Danger is not Spider-Man. It can't get there, right? This is another picture of the rock and the fortress. I mean, look at that. That's landscape. These are called wadis down here. This is where the water flows on either side, and it leaves a chunk of land in the middle. And that's why you have these really high plateaus that they build fortresses on. And I mean, they're almost impossible to get up the side of. I mean, look at that. It's a geographical region. Like, you can see the sea in the background. Okay, so this one technically isn't in Israel. This one is in Sri Lanka. But isn't that beautiful? Look at that place of safety, right? That's the imagery David is giving, because he's a military man. And this is where you go for safety if you're a military man living in the 10th century BC, right? You're talking about a rock and a fortress, right? So if you get this other idea in your head that, you know, we're talking about like a rock or something, then you're going to greatly... misunderstand what he's talking about. This is a place where if you're out and you're doing your thing and you find out the enemy's coming and somebody blows a shofar horn or something, you know you can go into the fortress and you're going to be safe. Like, fortresses like that, I guess they have to like lower down a ladder and then, you know, just to get you up, right? I mean, that's some pretty good stuff there. That's a shield. Sometimes the Bible will say a buckler, but it's generally a shield. That means something that you hide behind, and that protects you, right? Okay. Oh, there they are. Okay. So, Yahweh is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer, my God, my rock in whom I take refuge, my shield and the horn of my salvation. When he says my strength, that's his ability to accomplish. In this case, in David's case, that would be battle. But obviously, I don't know about you, I am not called to fight the enemies of Israel or to rule over a people. And so for us, our strength is going to be a different thing. And he's going to go into more detail into that later, talking about God's enablement and stuff. This is kind of a summary statement of the entire psalm, is how he calls upon Yahweh, who's worthy to be praised, and is saved from his enemies. He mentions the rock twice, the fortress, the high tower. It's not only a place of safety, it's a place of stability. It's a place where you can relax because your enemy cannot get you. It's a place where you can rest even more than just you can be not killed. It says the horn. And some people will think, oh, well, you know, that's like maybe like a horn that you blow like a shofar or something. No. In the Bible, I think the best interpretation here is talking about strength, where it'll talk about how the horn of the wicked is cut off. It's referring to oxen, where they'll have horns, and it represents their strength. So horns are representative of strength. So again, this is talking about God being David's strength, his shield. And as a result of who God is, a source of strength, a source of safety, whenever David needs to find safety or rest, he finds that in Yahweh. Yahweh is worthy to be praised, and in such a way, he is saved from his enemies. He takes refuge in Yahweh. So why does he need to take refuge in Yahweh? 4-6, looking at the distress that David is in. Now he's going to get into the weeds and start talking about the problem that he has. The cords of death encompassed me, and the torrents of vileness terrified me. The cords of Sheol, which is the place of death, surrounded me. The snares of death confronted me. In my distress, I called upon Yahweh and cried to my God for help. He heard my voice out of his temple, and my cry for help before him came into his ears. So death, 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 right? That's what he's facing. He's facing death, right? He's got death coming after him like nobody's business. And that is an ever-present problem for a person whose job it is to kill the enemies of Israel when he's called to do such a thing. But it's not something that's unknown to us. He's calling on him in that distress. We could call on him in whatever distress we have. But the distress that David faces pretty constantly is death, or the place of death. And it says, he heard my voice out of his temple. And it raises the question, wait a second, the temple hasn't been built yet. Well, it's probably best to understand this to mean that God is up in his holy temple, or his place where he rules before coming down, rather than to think that this would be a chronological error. And it says that God heard. God heard his cry for help. Here we are, insignificant, tiny. There's a billion of us Christians, right? Isn't that what there's supposed to be, about a billion Christians in this world? And my little voice cries out, oh, help me, help me. And Yahweh heard, right? Now, I mean, David, you can understand, you know, David's pretty important. He gets to be a picture of Jesus. He's the king of God's chosen people. But when my cry of distress goes up, would God hear me? I'm going to like totally steal thunder from whoever does Psalm 34. But, you know, they get that because of the fact that they got it before I could. I will bless Yahweh at all times. His praise shall continually be in my mouth. My soul will make its boast in Yahweh. The humble will hear it and rejoice. Oh, magnify Yahweh with me, and let us exalt his name together. I inquire of Yahweh, and he answered me, and delivered me from all that I dread. They look to him and are radiant. Their faces will never be humiliated. This poor man cried out, and Yahweh heard him, and saved him out of all of his troubles. The angel of Yahweh encamps around those who fear him, and rescues them. Oh, taste and see that Yahweh is good. How blessed is the man who takes refuge in him. O fear Yahweh, you his saints, for there is no want to those who fear him. The young lions do lack and suffer hunger, but they who inquire of Yahweh shall not be in want of any good thing. Come, children, listen to me. I will teach you the fear of Yahweh. Who is the man who delights in life and loves many days that he may say good? See good. Guard your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking deceit. Depart from evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it. The eyes of Yahweh are towards the righteous, and his ears are open to their cry for help. The face of Yahweh is against evildoers to cut off the memory of them from the earth. The righteous cry, and Yahweh hears, and delivers them out of all their troubles. Yahweh is near to the brokenhearted and saves those who are crushed in spirit. So the ear of Yahweh is listening for our cry. The eye of Yahweh is looking. But it's for the righteous. He's looking for the righteous. He's listening for the cries of the righteous. But wait, are we righteous? Well, that's what you have to consider, right? I mean, it's talking about his ears are open to the righteous, but is this something reserved only for those people who have obtained perfection? Did David obtain perfection? I don't think so. I think David did some pretty bad things. Yeah, he did some pretty bad things. But he loved God with his whole heart, and he was a man after God's own heart. Huh. Well, sometimes you read the Bible and you have questions, and then you have to think about them, right? So here we've got Psalm 34, and it talks about the fact that God's ears are hearing David's cry, and we find out in Psalm 34 that the ears of the Lord are towards the righteous, and his eyes are seeking out those that wholly follow him. Oh, wait, that's a different passage. So here we are with David dealing with death, 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 but God hears. God listens for the cry of the righteous, and he listens with the intent to deliver. And next, we're going to have theophany. Do you guys know what theophany is? It is, yeah, it's the poetic present God appearing on the scene. And it can be interesting, and a lot of times it's confusing, so people kind of just like, you know, they read past it real quick, and then they like get to the other side with the stuff that's a little easier to understand, right? I mean, well, we'll read it, and then we can look at it, because theophany can be a little bit, well, it's a little scary, right? 7 through 15. Then the earth shook and quaked, and the foundations of the mountains were trembling, and were shaken because he was angry. Do you remember any like earthquakes taking place in any of these battles that where David was delivered? Smoke went out of his nostrils and fire from his mouth devoured. Coals were kindled by it. He bowed the heavens and came down with thick darkness under his feet. It's like the heavens are a dome. And he just pushed them to the ground as he came down. He rode upon a cherub and flew, and he sped upon the wings of the wind. He made darkness his hiding place, his canopy around him, darkness of waters, thick clouds of the skies. Darkness? What's with all this darkness talk? You guys have any thoughts? From the brightness before him passed his thick clouds, hailstones and coals of fire. Yahweh also thundered in the heavens, and the Most High gave forth his voice, hailstones and coals of fire. He sent out his arrows and scattered them, and lightning flashes in abundance, and threw them into confusion. Then the channels of water appeared, and the foundations of the world were laid bare. At your rebuke, O Yahweh, at the blast of the breath of your nostrils. The danger here, and the aid to understanding this, is that this is a poetic device to help you understand about the majesty of God and the awesomeness of God. And basically, theophany is there to help us understand that our concept of God is too small. Right? God has to cloak his presence in order to come down, because otherwise he would burn us all to a crisp. Right? This is the God who created everything with his word. He's a consuming fire. If he doesn't cloak himself in darkness, he's just going to, you know, he's going to take us all out. And so you have these pictures. You know, there is some talk about his anger and his wrath here, but a lot of this is just his majesty, his transcendent power, his awesomeness in the presence of the created beings. You get a lot of this in the prophets, where it talks about like mountains skipping and melting like wax and that kind of stuff. We don't have any of these things recorded having taken place during David's battles or anything. This is poetic speech talking about the majesty, transcendence of God and his power. And it's very poetic. Interestingly, there's a lot of talk about the waters of the earth and the foundations of the world being laid bare, which is interesting because it's like an homage to current mythology that, unless you've gone to like really snooty Bible school, you would have no idea existed, right? Because back in those times, the Canaanite mythology going on was about these creatures of chaos, like Tiamat and the sea and the chaos and everything. And then the God of order comes in and brings order to everything by defeating these gods of chaos. And it's like if somebody was to talk about God and say that, you know, he could snap Thanos out of existence, right? It's talking about, it's using literary allusions to what people understood at the time to talk about God's superiority to those gods and how he's the one that brings order and he's the one who defeats the forces of chaos, right? And so theophany is, it's a poetical device to talk about the majesty of God and his transcendence and his greatness, and makes an excellent setup for talking about you know, who is like our God, who is beyond all other beings. And I think this helps if you think about the fact that our conception of God, I mean, a lot of people, they see God as like Santa Claus or something, right? A nice old man with a white beard, you know, and you go up to him and you ask him for stuff and he like puts you on his knee and pats you on the head and gives you what you want. God is a consuming fire. He is altogether, you know, majestic. And I mean, whatever conception of God you have in your head, it is insufficient, right? Our minds can be completely boggled with just his creation, let alone with him. With the things that he created at the voice of his mouth can boggle our minds, right? He is altogether other and beyond our imagination to even, our ability to even imagine. This is why you should fear God. And so theophany is an important part to help you get things straight when you're thinking about God. And then it talks about deliverance, 16 through 19. He sent from on high and he took me. He drew me out of many waters. I have this picture in my mind of David, like, drowning. And then God just, like, a hand coming down, reaching and pulling him out, right? But wait a second. Waters, the forces of chaos, God bringing order. Huh. Maybe that's why he was making that literary allusion previously, because now he's likening the troubles that David is in to the chaos and the primordial evil, and God is bringing order to this. He's rescuing David from the evil that's coming after him. It's all coming together. He delivered me from my strong enemy and from those who hated me, for they were too mighty for me. They confronted me in the day of my disaster, but Yahweh was my support. He brought me forth also into a broad place. He rescued me because he delighted in me. So he pulls him out of the waters, which are his troubles, and then he delivers him from the enemy. The day of his disaster. Have you had a day of your disaster? This isn't a bad day. This is the day of his disaster. And there's God delivering him on the day of his disaster, on his worst day. And what does he do? He takes him up to a place of peace, to a broad place, to a place where he's safe and can relax. David has been rescued. David has been rescued. He rescued me because he delighted in me. God delighted in David. God delights in his people. This speaks of God's character, God's righteousness, God's loyal love, what they say, Hesed in the Old Testament, his covenant love. And it raises the question because, you know, okay, so, you know, God's got this loyal covenant love for David. And for whatever reason, he doesn't for like Absalom or for Shimei, David's enemies, right? But they're Jews too. They're also in the covenant. Right? And this is the problem we oftentimes get into thinking, then we suppose on God's grace. David says that he delights in him. And so now he's going to move into another thing and talk about why God delights in him. He's going to talk about how one can be part of this relationship with God where he delights in you, right? The difference between David, who's in the covenant, and Absalom or Shimei, who are also supposedly in that covenant, right? And yet, God does not delight in them. Starting in verse 20, Yahweh has rewarded me according to my righteousness. According to the cleanness of my hands, he has recompensed me. Shades of that stuff in Psalm 34 where it talks about how God's ears are towards the righteous and towards their cry, right? Yahweh has rewarded me according to my righteousness. According to the cleanness of my hands, he has recompensed me. David murdered a man, stole his wife. For I have kept the ways of Yahweh and have not wickedly departed from my God. For all his judgments were before me, I did not put away his statutes from me. I was also blameless with him, and I kept myself from iniquity. Therefore, Yahweh has recompensed me according to my righteousness, according to the cleanness of my hands before his eyes. So now either David is considerably better behaved than we would gather from the book of Samuel, or David's sins have not been counted to him. Or David is counted clean before God. And here's where the balance comes, guys. Because in one sense, yes, David isn't going to make the grade. None of us are going to make the grade without being forgiven. But on the other hand, God is not just like the leader of a gang. And these are my boys, and they're all going to get away with whatever they want. And anyone who messes with them, I'm going to take them out. Because God expects righteousness from his people. Righteousness pleases him. And the expectation here is that David is saying that he has kept God's law. God has given him the law of Moses, and David has kept the law of Moses. Has he done it perfectly? No. No, he hasn't. But he's God's man. Right? His sins have been forgiven, and he's working to be righteous before God. Right? In the same way that we received forgiveness. Paul puts it this way. Shall we continue in sin that grace shall abound? Right? There's this whole thing where some people, they suppose on grace. You know, where the idea is that they think, oh, I'm forgiven for all of my evil deeds, so God will just impute me righteousness, so I don't need to actually be righteous myself. But grace is not just about being forgiven for the evil you've done. It's also the power to be a better person, right? Jesus comes and he teaches, blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are they that mourn. Blessed are the peacemakers, right? Have we done it perfectly? No, we haven't. But are we God's people? Have we taken the grace he's given us? Have we gotten to work? Because God is pleased by righteousness. And we're going to talk about more what righteousness brings forth. But David says, if you want God to delight in you, he wants righteousness. He wants you to be devoted to righteousness. Twice he mentions that he's rewarding him according to his clean hands or his righteousness. While we're not saved by being perfect and keeping the law of Moses or being perfect and doing what's right, we show our loyalty to God by obeying him. By devoting yourself to personal righteousness, you are showing your loyalty and your love to God. In David's case, it's the law of Moses. The children of Israel were told, you shall be holy, as I, your God, am holy. Now, did God pick the most righteous people? No. He said, it's not because you're better than anyone else. No, I picked you because you were the least. I want to show my glory in you. And then he says, you shall be holy as I'm holy. Not because they were holy, but because he's their God. And that should change who they are. That should change how they behave. That should change their attitudes. That should change everything about them. Because is the Father visible? It's not a trick question. No, he's not. He's not visible, right? We can't see him. Right? He's not visible, but what is visible is his people. His people are visible. Jesus says, let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. And who should have glory other than our God? Who is like him? Who is a rock and a fortress and a deliverer to us? Who does nobody have a proper understanding of? Who does nobody properly glorify, no matter how hard they try? Well, it's our God, right? He should be glorified nonstop by us, by our righteousness. We show our love for him and our loyalty to him. No, we don't earn our way into heaven. No, that's a free gift. But we love him and he loves us. And as his people, we should all be about his glory, right? And someone who is like, well, I've got fire insurance. They don't love him. They're not about his glory. The relationship is not there. Where's the delight? Because there's no love, right? And it's about the love. David goes on in 25 and 26. With the kind you show yourself kind, with the blameless you show yourself blameless, with the pure you show yourself pure, and with the crooked you show yourself astute. Oh. So the people that are good, he shows them kindness when they're kind. With their blameless, he's blameless. And when people are like, I've got God's arm behind my back, behind his back, so now I can do whatever I want. God shows himself astute. That means that you don't have God's arm behind his back at any point. A biblical example of thinking you have God's arm behind his back. Oh, God's not going to blow up Jerusalem. His temple's here. He would never blow up the temple because that's his place of dwelling. So we are quite safe from the Babylonians here. Thank you very much. Right? And God's like, nah, I left that place like earlier. That place can be blown up at will. They don't have God's arm behind his back. He proves himself astute. Astute. Okay, so I think David's just pointing out that, you know, apart from anything else, you know, your relationship with God, you know, you're doing what's right. God is rewarding us. He's very open-handed with his reward. His responses match our conduct. If we're crooked, God is astute or shrewd. Now we're going to move into the part about David being empowered by God. 27 through 29. It says, "For you save an afflicted people, but eyes which are lifted up you bring down." That's just normal God stuff to do, right? He tells Job, "Cast abroad the rage of your wrath, and behold everyone who's proud and abase him." You want to do God things? Find everyone who's proud and bring them down. That's just God stuff to do. "For you light my lamp, Yahweh my God illumines my darkness. For by you I can run upon a troop, and by my God I can leap over a wall." So he can see by God. God illumines his darkness. And again, we've got military imagery here. I can run upon a troop, I can leap upon a wall. Okay, so you've got to put yourself in the military conduct here. You're lined up in battle array against your enemy. And in battle, whoever chickens out gets killed. If you turn your back and you run, the other side is going to start killing you. More on this later, right? But David, despite the fact that he's a shepherd, he sees the enemy and God gives him courage and he charges into the enemy. And the enemy flees before him and his men, right? What's more, I can leap upon a wall. Do you guys know what that's talking about? Imagine now, if you will, a wall. And he's not holding the wall. He's taking the wall. They're attacking a wall, right? They didn't have siege engines. Things got a little easier once you got siege towers. And you could be on the same level as the tower. Okay, so if you've got like a wall that doesn't have room for people to stand on top of, then you put your ladder up there. You climb over the wall. You jump over. Now it's you against everyone inside that wall, right? Until other people get there. So the first person over the wall is almost certainly dead, along with 2 through like 47, right? And then once you get enough people over there, maybe you can get like some critical mass. But jumping that wall is scary. It's even worse if people are on top of the wall, because then you put your ladder up on the wall and they push it over as soon as you're trying to get up, or they like throw something on you, right? Taking a wall is scary stuff. If you survive after taking the wall in the Roman army, you've got a special award. Right? If you were the first person over the wall and you actually live to talk about it, you get honors and ceremonies and stuff. That's some scary stuff. David says, "You give me the courage to take a wall. I'll jump a wall. I got so much courage out of you, God," right? So that's that imagery that he's using. I can charge the enemy. I can take a wall. David is being empowered to be a great warrior, which is what he's called to do. Obviously, we're not supposed to take walls unless you have been called to, kill the enemies of Israel, which I don't know. Maybe you have. I haven't, right? That's not my calling or anything. But just as David is empowered to do what God has called him, we are also empowered to to do what God has called us to do. God exalts the humble, and he humbles the proud. He's our light in our darkness and our courage to continue. As for God, his way is blameless. The word of Yahweh is tried. He is a shield to all who take refuge in him. For who is God but Yahweh, and who is a rock except our God? So here's the rock thing is back, right? He's using that picture again. He's a shield to those who take refuge in him. Who is God but Yahweh, who's a rock except our God? Who other than our God is a place of safety? Because the others are all, you know, fake. The God who girds me with strength and makes my way blameless. He makes my feet like hinds' feet and sets me upon high places, which gets reused and is, I think, probably more famous in its use in Habakkuk. The setting my feet on hinds' feet. We could go on an excursus, but I don't think we've got time about that. He trains my hands for battle so that my arms can bend a bow of bronze. You have also given me a shield of your salvation, and your right hand upholds me, and your gentleness makes me great. You enlarge my steps under me, and my ankles have not given way. So, who can be counted on to be a refuge? Who's like our God? He's a real place of safety. He's a real rock. A place of safety and stability. All those who take refuge in him. The righteous and those who take refuge in him seem to be, right? They seem to be same, right? He's tried. He's blameless. The idea with the hinds feet, in case anybody doesn't know, those are like deer. And so they go up and have like really sure feet and stuff. So that like predators can't catch them when they get away. They're very agile. And it's interesting here to see how God's empowerment is not something in the future. It's something in the here and now. God continues to uphold him. His gentleness continues to make David great. He enlarges David's steps under him. Currently, his ankles have not given way, which you'd think was a basketball reference, but it hadn't been invented yet. So I can confidently assert that it is not talking about not getting your ankles broken in basketball. Okay, 37 through 42 is going to be another battle reference. It's a picture of what you do when your enemy is running away from you. Now that Yahweh has given David the victory, this is his experience with the enemy. I pursued my enemies and overtook them, and I did not turn back until they were consumed. So here's the picture. There he is. He's charging the enemy. The enemy is running for their lives. And your job when your enemy is running for their lives is to stab them in the back. I'm sorry, but that's the way ancient warfare was. You chase them down until they could make it to a place of safety. And if at all possible, you tried to like keep them from making it to a place of safety so that you could... That was what that whole thing with like the sun not going down with Joshua and stuff was because they wanted to kill as many Canaanites as humanly possible. And so this is that's what this is a picture of. I did not turn back until they were consumed. I crushed them so they were not able to rise. They fell under my feet. For you have girded me with strength for battle. You have subdued under me those who rose up against me. You have made my enemies turn their backs to me, and I destroyed those who hate me. Okay, so turning your back is just a euphemism for running away in battle. They cried for help, but there was none to save, even to Yahweh, but he did not answer them. Then I beat them as fine as the dust before the wind. I emptied them out as the mire of the streets. Yikes. They cried out to Yahweh. But they didn't have that relationship. Right? They didn't have that relationship. He did not delight in them. He did not deliver them as he did David, whose heart was holy God's. The battle is won. The enemy has fled. They're not even putting up a resistance. Who can stand against the might of Yahweh, who turns your enemies before you? And fortunately, this is talking about getting victory from God in the circumstances of your life. You don't necessarily have to stab anybody in the back because, again, we're not called to killing people in battle. I mean, the fact I have to explain these imageries, it means that we're fairly far off from actually having to do these sorts of things. So the results of victory, 43 through 45, you have delivered me from the contentions of the people. You have placed me as the head of the nations. A people whom I have not known serve me. Specifically the Philistines, the Arameans, basically everyone else in the region does what David says, because he has defeated them and now they're either tributaries or something similar. His garrisons are in their cities, even in larger, more powerful nations. Foreigners fade away and come trembling out of their fortresses. So that's the result of his victory. He's won all of these battles. This is David blessing God for giving him victory in all the endless battles that he's been in. So there's going to be a lot of that kind of imagery, right, going on here. And now he's going to talk about the inevitable conclusion that one draws from this, which is the praises that are due to God. Yahweh lives, and blessed be my rock, and let the God of my salvation be lifted high. Or as some of us might remember it, the Lord liveth, and blessed be my rock, and may the God of my salvation be exalted. Which goes nicely with, I will call upon the Lord who is worthy to be praised, so shall I be saved from my enemies, which is towards the beginning. If anyone remembers that song, we would sing it in rounds. Yeah. I just thought I wouldn't let it pass, since that's the way, oftentimes I think people are used to hearing that. The God who executes vengeance for me and subdues people under me, who delivers me from my enemies, surely you lift me above those who rise up against me. You rescue me from the violent man. Therefore, I will give thanks to you among the nations, O Yahweh. I will sing praises to your name. He gives great salvation to his king and shows loving kindness to his anointed, to David and to his seed forever. Yahweh lives. And that's a distinction between him and every other thing that people try to take refuge in. He lives. He's real. He delivers. And who is like him? The obvious answer is nobody's like him, right? No one both is willing and able to save the way he is. May his be exalted and glorified. Why? For his deeds, the mighty things he's done, and for his character, for who he is, because he exalts in righteousness and he expects righteousness out of his people. It's only right that he should be glorified. He is everything that's right about this world, right? His people should communicate that in the way they behave. Not because they have to or otherwise they're getting thrown in hell, but because we love him and because we want everybody to know about him and we want him to be glorified because of who he is and because there is no one like him. David recounts what he did for him, which, you know, is a little, you know, it's a little violent. But it was his job, and it's what God did for him. And then David praises him amongst the nations, or praises him among the Gentiles, because that's the same word, right? All the nations are hearing about God's glory, which is what the Israelites were supposed to be doing. They were supposed to be a priesthood to the nations. Not succeed as well as they could have, right? But that's what they were supposed to be doing. And the question arises, What has he done for you? And are you exalting him, both in telling about him amongst all the nations and devoting yourself to being the kind of person that glorifies him? When people see you and your good works, does that result in glory for the one who saved you? So I have a couple takeaways. First of all, God is altogether glorious. So we should glorify him because our conception of God is too small. In aid of that, I just want to read, this is one of my favorite passages when talking to my students about the greatness of God. And I think it's kind of about the greatness of God. It's Isaiah chapter 40. It says, who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand? The waters. It's talking about the waters of the earth. Right? Now, if Noah had gotten all the waters of the world and put them in a big jug, and then he had opened the tap so that the water could flow at the rate of 1 gallon per second, that tap would still be flowing. That's a lot of water, guys. That's a lot of water. The hollow of his hand, see that little dip right there? God puts all the waters of the earth in the hollow of his hand. The next one's even bigger. He encompasses the heavens by the span, which is this number right here, right? But it's all the heavens. Do you guys have any idea how big the heavens are? How big space is? No. No, you don't. It beggars your imagination. I mean, even the distance from us to the closest star that is not, you know, like our star, is outside of our ability to conceive of. Let alone the distance between our galaxy and the next galaxy. I mean, you literally, if you go to the edge of our galaxy and you shoot a gun at the next galaxy, it will never get there. Because that other galaxy is flying faster than a bullet away from us. Except for Andromeda. That one's approaching. It's still going to take it billions of years to get here because it's so far away. And it's going faster than a bullet. And they got that, you know, that Hubble Space Telescope thing. And they pointed it at this, like, little patch of the sky where you couldn't see anything. Right? Just like it was dark. You know, there's, like, little spaces in between the stars and stuff. Right? And they blew it up. And then they took a little dot that was dark and blew that up. Thousands of galaxies, guys. Thousands of galaxies in the pinprick of a pinprick in a dark part of the sky. And he said, let there be stars in the heavens. And boom, stars in the heavens. He spoke it into existence. Anyway, you just think about it for just a second, okay? I mean, oh my goodness, this God that we serve, so beyond our ability to comprehend, power like that, right? And then you pop down a little bit. It says, who has encompassed the spirit of Yahweh, or as his counselor has informed him? With whom did he counsel, and who gave him understanding? Who taught him the path of justice and taught him knowledge and made him know the way of understanding? That would be nobody. If there's anything to know, it's because he came up with it. It's his understanding. Almost every drug that we have today, we just got by like finding some substance that God created and going, ooh, look what I'll do, right? And like copying it and figuring out some way to isolate it. They found the venom from like cone snails and they're like, we can make 14 different drugs out of this, right? Like aspirin is the bark of a tree, right? Have you ever gone outside and looked we have an automatic watering system for our planet, right? There are these clouds. They just like flow over the earth and keep everything watered. You don't have to do anything. It's powered by the sun that's near us. And the earth has a force field to keep the sun from destroying us. And then the sun has like this other force field. And you know when those meteors that are supposed to destroy the earth, they can't because they run into Jupiter first. The more you understand, the more you understand that God understood everything to make us a little fishbowl so that we can live. And it just, the more you think about God's creation, the more it boggles your mind. Who is a God like ours who did all these things? And it doesn't matter how much we do this, we'll never even approach a proper understanding of how great God is. Right? You can just boggle your mind all day long. And there's more to do, right? Who is like our God? And that's David's point, right? Who's a God like this that is a place of safety for us, that we can take refuge in, right? He has all wisdom. He has all goodness. He has all power. Who is a God like ours? And God is glorified in the righteousness of his people. And I kind of talked about this a little bit, but this is something I want us to take away from this. I talked about the fact that Israel isn't chosen because they're better than anybody else. He gives them the perfect law. And that's what David was living under. He was trying to follow Yahweh using God's perfect law. Was he perfect? No. But we have more than David did. We've got God's Spirit inhabiting us, giving us a connection to God and the power to not sin. We should be able to do it better than David. We have all of the scriptures, not just some of them. We have all of them. We have the complete revelation of God. We have God's Spirit, which gives us everything pertaining to life and godliness. We have the scriptures that give us doctrine, reproof, correction, and instruction in righteousness. If anyone should be able to glorify God in their lives, it should be us. We have every advantage. We have a link to God himself through the Spirit to empower us to do what's right, to convict us when we're not doing what's right. And God deserves that glory. He deserves more than the glory that we can give him. And finally, I think it's just something that I always like to watch because of the fact that this is an example of that, is that God is glorified by delivering his people through judgment. I don't know if you've noticed this, but there's a lot of examples of it. God delivers the people in the flood. Not a lot of people, but he does. He delivers some people, his righteous people. During the Exodus, he delivers his people, messes up the Egyptians. People have something to talk about for a good 1,000 years afterwards. Don't mess with the Israelites. They follow Yahweh. Yahweh messed up Egypt. During the time of the judges, again and again, God judges their enemies. David's enemies that he brings up, Babylon, who get themselves, judged for, what they did to Israel, despite the fact they were being used as an instrument of judgment at the time because Israel was doing what was wrong. And the great and terrible day of the Lord, where we look forward to sin being done away with in God's judgment, which is going to be entirely to God's glory, that he is going to deliver us through judgment. And that's what he does for David in here, is that he's glorifying himself from delivering David, and David is glorifying him because of the judgment that he brings down on the enemies of Israel. And here's what we need to understand as we go about bringing God the glory. Our natural inclination is that we are the protagonist in the story, and we're not. We're at best the sidekick, right? Generally speaking, we're the two-bit sidekick villain that for some reason the protagonist decided that he was going to rescue and then allow to be on his side afterwards. The hero of the story is always God. He's the story. This is his story. He's the hero of this story. And we try to put ourselves in the center, but we're not. It's God's story. He's the hero, right? We're not. And so he glorifies himself in his story by by delivering his people that were his enemies, but then he turned them around and made them into his people. And then he protects them and he saves them. And so David says, who is like our God to deliver? I think that's all I've got, you guys.